Live from Utrecht, this is Bitcoin
Explained.
Hey, Sjors.
Hey, Aaron. Been a while.
Yes. Welcome back on our... Hey, this is our 100th episode, Sjors.
That is correct. Episode 100.
I did not think we would make it with our biannual podcast. But well, we're back.
Yeah, we've exponentially approached it, exponentially slowing down approached it, but we made it. Well, at least we made it to the start.
Yeah, we're sticking to our semi-official rule to only record in person, so that's why it took a while. I was not in the Netherlands, but now I'm back in beautiful, sunny Utrecht for a beautiful, fresh Bitcoin Explained episode.
Exactly, and we're going to pick a very fresh topic for a note that was released only 3 months ago.
Yes, we do make an episode. Basically, I think we've made an episode for every new Bitcoin Core release since we started the podcast. So we should we're at least keeping that up.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so this is Bitcoin Core 31, which came out when?
In April 19th.
Fantastic.
And in fact, there is now a 31.1.
Right, that was just
released with
ask.
Some bug fixes.
Right, we're not even well, I guess these are just bug fixes. So it's when did this come out? We can make.
But the
it
bug fix
fresh.
Is related to one of the features we're going to cover. So it's good that we had to wait for this bug fix.
Okay. Well, is CoinKite still sponsoring us, George?
I think so.
should I?
We're optimistically going to assume that they still are.
Should I endorse or advocate for their projects just in case?
We should at least thank them.
Dear listener, check out CoinKite with the cold, your favorite hardware wallet vendor with the cold card, the open dime, the sets card, the tap signer. What else do they have, Shorts?
I have no idea.
CoinKite.
These things.
CoinKite.com. Check it out. I assume that's their website.
Yes. All right.
Or just Google CoinKite and see where it takes you.
I'm pretty sure they have every conceivable domain.
I would think so. Okay, Sjors. So Bitcoin Core 31 released a couple of months ago, and mm-hmm. you made a special selection for our dear listeners of some of the highlights in the new Bitcoin Core release. Is
exactly.
that right?
A highly curated list.
Yeah. Okay, so the first one you picked, which we'll discuss, is there's been... We wrote down cluster mempool. Is cluster mempool? First question: is this a completely new thing? So the term cluster mempool, because I feel like I heard it before.
Yeah,
is that because we were discussing that it was coming, or is so? My question is: has cluster mempool been updated, or is cluster mempool a new thing in Bitcoin Core 31?
I believe that 31 is the first version that has cluster mempool
okay,
in it.
Right, that
the concept has been around for a few years, so it's been mentioned on different podcasts, maybe even ours, but I'm not sure.
Okay, so this was a long time coming, and now in Bitcoin, 3 months ago in Bitcoin Core 31, there's now cluster mempool.
Yes, and you will probably not notice a difference.
As a regular user.
As a user,
yeah. Okay, what is cluster mempool? Just take it from the top.
Well, I don't completely understand it, so maybe I'm not the right person
that's
to ask.
That's a great start.
But it is just a better,
That's why people listen to our podcast, to
exactly.
get sort of half-baked, they think this is how it works type of
exactly.
explanations.
Well, it depends on the subject, but I mean, the bottom line is that it is a sane version of the mempool. The original mempool code was kind of awkward, mm-hmm. difficult to reason about. One of the weirdest aspects of it was that So the mempool is there to decide, or it's really, it should reflect what miners are going to mine, basically, first.
Yes.
Right? And so ideally, if your mempool is full and you need to kick something out, then you're going to kick the most worthless transaction out and not the most valuable one.
And by that, you mean the transaction that pays the lowest fee?
Well, not necessarily, because it's more complicated than okay. that, right? Because it's not just about the fee that your transaction pays, but it's also how much your parents pay or how much your uncles and nephews and et cetera pay.
And I guess that's the point here.
And that was very complicated to reason about. So there were some strange scenarios where if the mempool was full, you would actually kick out the transaction that, if you were a miner, would be the first one you'd want to mine because of this intricate relationships between transactions.
Okay, but the simple example of this is child pays for parents, right? So there's a transaction that pays a very low fee, but from that transaction are coins spent again in a new transaction that pays a high fee.
Yes.
So as a miner, you want to mine both of those, including the very low fee transaction, because then you also get the high fee from the next transaction.
Yeah, and as far as I know, that worked. But once you make the scenarios more complicated, things do not behave very well.
Yeah, yeah. But so that's the point I'm making. That already worked, right? Bitcoin Core already had at least the basic child pays for parent logic also in the mempool, I think, right?
Yeah, as far as my limited understanding is that it was able to reason basically from the ancestors down to the children, mm-hmm. or from the children up to the ancestors. Like right, you can go down the family graph up or down.
Like one step.
But not sideways. And I think now it can, you know, can take into account like, oh, you know, this parent and child are worthless, but they have a rich cousin that's paying a lot of paying a lot of fees.
Okay.
And so we should include that.
So they're connected through, I don't know, like the grandfather in this analogy, or you can just draw more.
Yeah, so you have a parent, a child.
The term cluster kind of says it. You can take a bigger cluster of transactions into account when it comes to which transactions you want to keep in the mempool or kick out of the mempool.
Yeah, and where this becomes important is, we have talked about this previously, I think, in equally vague terms, things like pinning attacks, where you're trying to escape from a lightning channel, so you broadcast a transaction, and then somebody else makes a child of that transaction that makes it so that you will never get confirmed because the total fee is too low. And so you want to bump that fee, but you can't because you hit some sort of limit. And there's a lot of these annoying, complicated cases.
Real quick, I don't know if you know the answer to this question, but is it the case that the more sophisticated miners and mining pools were practically already doing this, but Bitcoin Core was just not keeping up, and therefore mempools weren't really reflecting what was actually being mined?
No,
or is this also really an innovation that miners are going to use?
There's a couple of different things happening here, because as far as people that have looked at what blocks look like, mm-hmm. The quirks in the blocks suggest that they use Bitcoin Core to decide what goes in the block.
Okay.
However, they might have tweaked things like the minimum fee rate, right? So last summer we saw that suddenly, miners started including 0.1 sats per V-byte kind of transactions. And that is a case of the miners are ahead of what the Bitcoin Core was doing by default.
Yeah.
And then Bitcoin Core tends to follow what the miners are doing because of this rule that we want to basically anticipate what's going to be mined.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that they use some sort of sophisticated algorithm as far as I know. In fact, it's kind of the opposite. Is that if the mempool is not as sophisticated as it can be, there is an incentive for somebody to say, hey, I can, you know, make better block templates than Bitcoin Core does. Why don't you send the transactions to me as a sort of an accelerator?
Mm-hmm.
And then you get centralization pressure. So Bitcoin Core kind of needs to be as good as possible while not wasting too many resources of the node.
Yeah.
Because there's a computational time there, right? Every time a transaction comes in, you need to do some calculation to see if it's good or bad.
Yeah. As good as possible from the perspective of a miner that wants to maximize fee revenue, essentially, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Was there a specific? Was this just something that was kind of always on Bitcoin Core's to-do list? But you know, it's hard and it's complicated, and that's why it took a while. Or is there a more specific reason it was implemented now? Because
you told me
that it has something to do with Arc, maybe also.
No, it predates it. So the idea of cluster mempool predates Arc, I think, by several years.
Okay.
I mean, over the past 10 years or so, I guess since Lightning especially,
mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of discussion about pinning attacks that I just described mm-hmm. before. And then you have things like RBF, which has a bunch of different rules. Like it has some rules in the BIP and it has some rules, actual rules that are not in the BIP. And, you know, it got quite convoluted. It wasn't very elegant. It was kind of a hodgepodge of, well, if we make this rule and this exception, and then, you know, we have a carve out here. And it was kind of a messy set of rules that was just good enough, but then people kept finding ways to still pin you as a Lightning operator. So there were stakes. And this was kind of a redesign of it, which people came up with several years ago, thinking of how can we design the mempool logic from scratch, the sorting logic from scratch, in a way that gets rid of all these weird exceptions too. So I think a couple of rules have been dropped in how RBFs are processed and exceptions have been removed. So it's more elegant and seems to be more robust.
Okay, and this is a very, I mean, we're talking about the mempool as a kind of a very individual thing in the sense of you have your own mempool and you know every node has that.
Mm-hmm.
But this, I assume, automatically, or I mean, you can answer it, automatically, this also applies to what you share with your peers?
As far as I know, you share with your peers the moment you add it into your own mempool.
Right, exactly.
So that doesn't really change. I mean, if for some reason a transaction now goes into your mempool because of these different heuristics give a slightly different result, then yeah, you would be sharing it with your peers.
Yeah, but that was like a whole project, right, that Gloria Zhao in particular was working on, I think, with the package relay. So is this related to that? Is this kind of the same project in that sense?
So my understanding is that this will make package relay possible. Like it's
okay.
So what we discussed in a previous episode, the one parent, one child special case of package relay.
Yeah.
So it's a package of two.
Mm-hmm.
And this is quite useful because if you need to get out of a Lightning channel, that's usually just two transactions. One is the penalty transaction that you want to apply or the escape transaction. And the other is the fees that you want to add because when you made the channel, you agreed on either very low fees or in the case of ephemeral dust, no fees at all. And so the special case of two was possible even without cluster mempool. But the hope is that with cluster mempool, you can reason about a much larger set of transactions. And then my optimistic take, and could be wrong, is that things like ARC would now become possible. Because with ARC, you have, say, 25 transactions to get out. And don't ask me how ARCs work.
Mm.
you might have a package of 25 because you have a tree of transactions that are needed to escape. But right now, the nodes tend to process transactions one at a time. Whereas in such a scenario, maybe all the transactions don't pay enough fees except the very last one, which pays all the fees.
Mm.
And the node needs to understand that it needs to consider all 25 of them and that the last one is paying all the fees. And I think that's possible with package relay. And then hopefully cluster mempool makes it so that the node can reason about these big packages. It doesn't right now. It just has the better architecture under it.
Sorry, that last sentence caught me off guard. It doesn't have it right now?
No. So we have cluster mempool, so it's a better architecture that might allow packages larger than two.
Uh-huh.
But we don't do that yet.
Oh, okay. But that gets back to how do you even get the transactions in the first place? And if other peers don't get the whole cluster to you? Oh.
Well, okay. So the cluster is a bunch of transactions that might have been given to you sequentially. So it builds up over time.
Right. But you need to keep them in order to know if the child or the parents are also valid, right? You need to
not
reject
normally,
them, which is the point.
Yeah, when you start out, you will accept anything that's over one set per V-byte because your mempool is empty. You've got 300 megabytes.
Yeah, or 0.1
so you build
set
up,
per V-byte, I think, right
yes,
now, right?
Yes, exactly. So you build up this mempool, including the clusters that are in it, of related transactions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, your mempool starts overflowing. Mm-hmm. And so you now have to decide which one are you going to throw out.
Yeah.
And that is when you look at these clusters and you find the worst cluster and then each cluster is divided into chunks. So you take any given set of transactions that are related as a cluster and you kind of squash it in a line and in a way that the best part of the cluster is at the top and the worst part of the cluster is the bottom. And so you take the worst part of the cluster, you take the worst part of the worst cluster and you throw that out. And that's a very fast calculation now.
Okay, but you throw that out in a way that the rest of the cluster is still valid.
Yes, so the way you squash the cluster, like you flatten it in a way that it's that one side of it doesn't need the other side of it.
Right.
So they go. There's a certain order to it. So you want to order transactions by the most fees first, whenever possible. But if that's not possible because there's a child for parents, you might have the first transaction is a cheap parent, the second transaction is a cheap child, and then the third transaction is a grandchild that pays a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first chunk. And then the next chunk might be some other uncle transaction that pays a little bit less than the super rich child, etc. And that means that if you cut the tail off from the cluster, like you're throwing away the least valuable part of it,
mm-hmm.
but you're keeping it. And you can cut it at multiple places, but not at all places, right? Because like you said, there's some transactions depend on each other. And so that it's sorted in a way that you can cut it in a number of places without breaking those dependencies.
Right.
And then you cut the worst part. And for mining, you do the opposite. So for mining, you look at the best cluster and the best part of the cluster.
maybe I'm going a bit too much into the weeds right now, but in this hypothetical scenario that you describe, you're starting with an empty mempool, basically. But mm-hmm. You're starting with an empty mempool, basically.
Yes.
But in reality, most of the time, you don't start with an empty mempool. Your mempool is kind of always full by default, right?
Well, not today, but let's say it is full.
Yeah,
and a new transaction comes in. So then what you have to do, as far as I understand it, is you look at your mempool and see, which is this relevant to any of the clusters I have?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it a completely new cluster because it's unrelated to anything I've seen? If it is a new cluster, then you just see, okay, is this new cluster better than any of my existing clusters?
But then you need the other transactions in the cluster as well, right?
No, if it's a new...
how can you tell?
So a new transaction can be a cluster of one. Like, it's not related to anything else in the mempool. It's basically just spending from something that's confirmed.
Yes, but what if that is a very low fee paying transaction and you don't see the rest of the cluster yet? Then you would normally throw it out, even though maybe the rest.
Yeah.
Of
so
it.
So if you receive so a new that, transaction,
you need package really ultimately, right, or some form of it. That it is can also be compatible.
Yeah. With so
it.
If you see a new transaction that is not related to any of the clusters you're aware of, but it is part of a cluster apparently, then yeah, you might just reject it, and you'd need something like package relay, especially big package relay, to say,
yes,
okay, here's somebody escaping from their arc, for example, 25 transactions. Mm-hmm. I see the first one of that 25 transactions. I'm like, well, this is a new cluster, but it pays nothing, so I'm going to ignore it. And the second one, I'm also going to ignore it because it's paying from a parent that I, you know, spending from a parent that I don't know about. So that's where this comes in. But in the case where it's just a single transaction and you need to evaluate it on its own, either it's better than any of your clusters or parts of the clusters, and then you know where to sort it and you put it in the mempool, or it's not and you ignore it. And that's a fast calculation, so you can do that when you get lots of new transactions every second.
Okay, so then I think this will be my last question on this topic. Ideally, we'd want package relay for clusters, right?
I think so, but some people might say no. I'm not sure.
But in any case, that's not here yet. That's not here yet.
No, the only package relay for clusters is a cluster of two.
Okay, right. Okay. Well, that answers my question. That was my question. So right now, cluster mempool works for your mempool and you make more complicated, complex, advanced calculations for that. But it's not necessarily all relayed as a package yet.
Exactly.
And maybe that one, you say there's arguments against doing that also.
Maybe. I mean, if you look at the one child, one parent example in Lightning, the truck transactions or the ephemeral dust transactions, the question there is, what is the maximum cost that an attacker can impose on you? So right now, I think that's capped at like 10,000 sats in total. So that's like $5 now, that the worst that the attacker can do to you. But if you say, okay, we're allowing a cluster package of size million transactions, then I don't know, maybe the attacker can do more damage to you. But maybe that's not too bad.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay. In any case, short summary, cluster mempool, your node, your mempool will make more advanced calculations to determine what to keep and what to throw out, which benefits miners that would use this to create blocks and individual nodes, because then their mempools better reflect the blocks that are actually mined, which benefits the estimation and stuff like that and relay. And correct?
Yeah. I think some of this will or is being used for fee estimation too.
Right. Does that conclude our topic?
Yeah, I think so. We can
cluster mempool. Okay. So the next upgrade in Bitcoin Core 31, there's now a function called private broadcast.
A startup option called private broadcast.
Okay.
And it's been fixed in version 31.1. So if you want to use it, you should use 31.1 to be on the safe side.
Mm.
What it does is, so right now, if you make a transaction and you send it, it just goes to a bunch of your peers. And that's not great if one of your peers happens to be Chainalysis and they can sort of figure out, oh, well, I saw it from you first and not from others, so maybe it's yours, right? So this, you're kind of potentially leaking the origin of your own transaction. In the past, there were proposals like Dandelion. I don't know if we've ever covered that.
Oh, that's years ago.
Yes.
That's like a 10-year-old proposal. I don't think we ever covered that.
Okay. It's quite an old proposal. It's quite cool, but it basically said, okay, we're going to send a transaction, one hop, another hop, like just as a stem, basically, and then it explodes at some random node in the distance.
Right.
That turns out to be extremely complicated to implement for all sorts of reasons. But there's a sort of a poor man's dandelion, I guess, where is this? So instead of connecting to your peers, when you have this new transaction, you open a new Tor connection and
Good old Tor?
Yes. Okay. A completely new Tor circuit, I think. And then you find a peer randomly on the internet. You connect to it. You say, hi, here's a transaction, bye.
Right.
And then you wait and you see if any of your peers, normal peers, announce this transaction.
To you, basically.
To you, yeah. Because then you know it kind of went through the network. Right. If not, then you just keep trying. You keep trying another Tor peer, etc.
Right.
So this is still a bit cumbersome to use, but it's there.
Right, right. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, the problem, I mean, yeah, one of the ways to de-anonymize Bitcoin users is basically for, you know, the companies like Chainalysis. Am I pronouncing it?
There are different people who pronounce it in different ways for different reasons, but it's Chainalysis. But
they actually monitor the Bitcoin network itself to see where transactions originate, which is not perfect. You know, it's not foolproof, but at least it gives. You know, it's supposedly used, right?
Yeah. So the first peer that you, if you're a spy and you're connecting to lots of different nodes, and the first node you hear about for a given transaction is, you know, more likely to be the original one than the second node hear it from.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So then the solution now is to just use, sounds simple enough. Why is this new? Well, I didn't propose it 10 years, so it's easy to say now, but you would think someone could have just come up with this 10 years ago. Is there something difficult about this, or is this...
No, I suspect the idea itself is actually might already be at least 5 years old, if not more. It's possible that somebody proposed it, then came up with Dandelion. Mm. That sounded really cool. And then you try that and it doesn't work. And then it took another 5 years to get this one-shot Tor thing through. I think the idea is not super new. The downside, I think, is relying on Tor, because it's kind of like this black box trust assumption. It's like, okay, we hope Tor actually works and doesn't. Because if this doesn't work... Let's say Tor was fake, like it doesn't actually protect your privacy. Then you are creating a connection to the spy agency and telling them, this is my transaction.
And I want to keep it private.
Because you're only using this connection to send your transactions. There's no decoys.
Yeah, it's a dependency, right? So ideally, would not want to...
And there's some practical issues. Yeah, how do you configure your node to use Tor, etc.? Now, a lot of these node-in-the-box solutions will do that for you.
Okay, so this is new in Bitcoin Core 31, but how do you, because it's not by default, right? You have to actually opt in somehow?
Yeah, you have to turn on a setting and then you have to do something special when you make a transaction to use this, I think.
Okay, and if I understand correctly, this is not implemented in the wallet right now. As a Bitcoin Core wallet user, you can't use this. You would have to... What do you actually have to do? You have to construct your own transaction and then...
I think you create the transaction as normal, but you don't send it. You don't broadcast it. You just copy it and then send it over. Copy it to an RPC command.
Okay.
So it's a little tedious, but...
It's a little bit manual labor.
I can imagine that you could add this to the wallet. It's not rocket science. It's just one step at a time.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a new option. That's a new feature in Bitcoin Core 31. I think that basically covers it, right? It's kind of straightforward, or is there more to say about this?
Yeah, no, that covers it.
Yeah. Okay, great. More privacy is great. I like it.
Okay.
ASMAP.
Or ASMAP, depending on your mood. We had an episode about this, so just listen to it. No, back then we...
Did we do a whole episode on only... ASMAP?
I think so, yeah. We had a whole bunch of episodes about Eclipse attacks, and one of them was about ASMAP.
Okay, ASMAP. To recoup that a little.
The quick summary is that we don't like Eclipse attacks.
What is an Eclipse attack again?
It's where you are connected to only one person.
Pretending
to be several.
Yeah.
And then they can feed you maybe an alternative blockchain or pretend there's no update or... All sorts of shenanigans you don't want.
If every peer you're connecting to is actually the same, you know, attacker, then they can give you blocks that are double spending or whatever. Like, it's not necessarily the longest chain you're seeing then.
And if you are a miner, then, you know, they can make you produce a block that's not actually on the most work chain, and then they can use, they can abuse you to double spend somebody else, right? So it's not just you as a normal node, but it's also you as a minor node where you do not want to be eclipsed.
Yeah. Bottom line, you want to be connected to the actual network. You want to see actual blocks that the rest of the network sees. So an eclipse attack stops that. So now, so this is a solution, or this is a measure against eclipse attacks.
Yeah, so over the years, lots of different measures have been taken to prevent eclipse attacks. One of the measures that's been in there for quite long, I think from the beginning, is that when we decide who to connect to, we use this thing called buckets. We have a whole list of peers, or a whole list of nodes in our database that we think are nodes, so just a bunch of IP addresses essentially. And we say, okay, let's take all the IP addresses that start with a 1, and we make only one connection to those, and then we look at all the IP addresses that start with a 5, and we only make one connection to those, and that's how we diversify the people that we connect to. And that's just based on what the IP addresses look like, which is not great because there's companies like Amazon that have lots of different IP addresses that start with different first digits, basically. So ASMAP is a project to actually look at these owners and group those and try to diversify across actual owners of the network. So there's a bunch of university research projects out there that are monitoring. I think it's basically the gossip between different internet providers. So AS is an autonomous system. It's a group of IP addresses. Could be your ISP, could be Amazon, could be Google. Sort of one entity that controls a group of IP addresses. And this stuff is gossiped around the internet because it's needed in order for you to find a route from A to B. Goes through all these autonomous systems. And so there are these giant databases of exactly which IP address belongs to which autonomous system. And what happens is every month or so, or every 2 months, a group of volunteers, Bitcoin Core-related volunteers, come together and at the same time try to download these giant maps from those research institutions, a couple of different ones in the world. And then they do that at exactly the same time because this map changes every second or more often. And then if they all have the exact same view, some math is performed on it and it becomes like a 1 megabyte file that's added to Bitcoin Core now. And this 1 megabyte file just means that for given any IP address, tell me that it's like what group does it belong to. It doesn't really give you the name. It just says, okay, this IP address is a different group than this other IP address. Because the only thing you care about is that you don't connect to the same group twice, the same autonomous system twice.
Right. Okay. This is I think it's a pretty hypothetical attack, right? Like, but the potential attack here would be that, say, Amazon, whoever controls Amazon or whoever hacked into Amazon, they control a whole bunch of IP addresses now. And these IP addresses don't even look the same because Amazon is so big. They have so many IP addresses under their control. So to prevent an eclipse attack from such an attacker, there's a more accurate way to map which IP addresses belong to which entity or behind which ISP or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And from there, these buckets are then used for a node to say, okay, connect to a diverse range of it.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're not just connected to Amazon. We're connected to all kinds of different ISPs and
yes, and so in practice, this probably means that some obscure internet provider in Zambia will now get more connections because they're sort of picked as the not standard option, and Amazon might get fewer connections.
Right, okay. And these maps, as maps, these are actually... These are files. You actually download these on your Bitcoin Core node. These are now on your hard drive.
Yeah. So what's already been available is since we did that episode in 2022, is this ability to download this ASMAP file, put it in your node, and then enter it in your config, and it would use it. What's new now is that by default Bitcoin Core comes with one of those maps.
Okay, and uses them, or is that actually?
Yeah. No, you still have to turn that on.
Okay,
but now you just set ASMAP 1. And it works rather than downloading a file, putting it somewhere, etc.
Right.
And then every time Bitcoin Core updates, the new version will have a new map that
Right.
If you've turned this feature on, it will use the new map.
Yeah, it's not automatically updated or gossiped around. It's just whenever there's a new Bitcoin Core release, you get the newest ass maps. And
yes, and you can still download your own or make your own, but that's kind of difficult. And the reason it took so long is because we kind of don't like shipping a blob that is hard to reproduce, that's hard to verify. So that's why there's this ritual of like multiple people in different places of the world try to make the same AS map file at the exact same time. And then if like three of them or so have the same result, then there's at least some auditability that this process was fair. And then you can look at the code and see how it works. Right. It's not ideal and because these, like the map of the internet, there's no official map of the internet. So these basically maps that people are downloading exist for 1 second and then they change. Just like Google Maps, I guess, you know, every time there's a different street somewhere in the world, the whole map changes.
Yeah, there's no official map, but this is publicly available data. And the Bitcoin Core developers themselves actually make use that to turn it into maps. This is a Bitcoin Core specific project.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure other projects could use it if they have the same need to avoid Eclipse attacks.
Right. Okay. So that's also new in Bitcoin Core 31?
Mm-hmm.
Did I cover it? Is there anything else to say about that?
No.
Okay. Smaller risk of Eclipse attacks. Also sounds good.
Yeah.
I like privacy. I like smaller risks of Eclipse attacks as well. All good so far.
Great.
What was the first thing again? Oh, cluster mempool. I like more fees and more accurate mempools as well. Sure. All good so far.
I'm glad you're happy.
Very. Last one. Oh, no, I wanted to ask. Wait, was this topic or the last one? No, this was the last topic on the private broadcast. I do want to ask. So you mentioned there was a bug and it's fixed. What was the bug, actually? What was the bug?
If I remember, it's related to another episode we probably have done, which is about the V2 transport, the encrypted peer-to-peer network.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is if you try to connect to a node that has the encrypted... if you try to connect to another node and you want to use a new encrypted communication protocol, if that doesn't work because they don't actually speak the encrypted protocol, you kind of disconnect and reconnect and then try the unencrypted protocol.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over Tor, it doesn't matter whether you use encrypted or unencrypted, if both sides are on Tor anyway, because Tor itself encrypts too, so it's kind of double.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe you're connecting via Tor to somebody who's not on Tor through the exit nodes, right? So you need the encryption. But the problem was, I think that if the V2 connection didn't work, it would disconnect and reconnect, but the reconnection would not go over Tor.
Right.
So that's very bad.
Right. So you're trying to get privacy, but then when it fails, you just give up on the privacy.
Yeah. And this is exactly what I said. One of the reasons why these features like this are scary is because you are trusting the black box Tor. And in this case, if you make a mistake, because you're only using this connection for this thing that you say it's yours, it's extra dangerous when something goes wrong like this.
Right. And so it did go wrong at the initial
I'm
release.
Sure it was like a somewhat of an edge case, but it still like, you know, makes it clear that you want to be careful with features like this because they can't be a foot gun if they go wrong.
Right. And in any case, so it was fixed in 31.1.
Yeah. And that's why we waited with this episode, right?
Exactly. Okay. Last topic. I think that's the last topic for us, right? Already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wrote down IPC interface and I already forgot what it... IPC interface, yours?
Tell me. That's a mining related stuff. So
oh, right, yes.
Stratum V2 related.
Right.
Right.
So this is... Okay, just take it. Go for it.
Yeah, I don't know how much we've covered that Stratum V2 in earlier discussions, but...
I think we had a whole episode on that also some point. But that's maybe like 3 years ago by now. I think that's been a while.
In any case, the Stratum V2 system allows you to make your own block templates, among other things.
If you're a miner, yeah.
Exactly. You can make them even if you're not mining. It's
that's kind of pointless. Useless. But yeah. Sure.
So the initial idea was to have Bitcoin Core actually speak the Stratum V2 protocol and provide block templates. But it was a bit controversial to add even more complexity to Bitcoin Core because it's already a big project. So the idea then became to say, okay, we're not going to implement Stratum V2 itself, but we're going to just offer all the information that Stratum V2 needs.
Mm-hmm.
So you install Bitcoin Core, and then you install a separate piece of software called a template provider. that mm-hmm. template provider speaks to your own node on one side, and mm-hmm. it speaks to Stratum V2, the rest of the Stratum V2 ecosystem on the other side.
The it's kind of like a translator. Pool, then, you mean?
The mining pool or yet another piece of software, because Stratum V2 can be multiple pieces of software.
Okay.
So in the scenario where you are mining your own block templates, you have Bitcoin Core that talks to the template provider. The template provider then talks to the job decorator server, sorry, client. And the job decorator client talks to the mining pool to okay. declare the job. So yeah. it doesn't really matter. Like in practice nowadays, I think there's wizards. And so you just say, do you want to solo mine or do you want to use a pool? Do you want to make your own templates? Yes, no. And it just installs whatever you need.
Mm-hmm.
So it hopefully gets to a simplicity level that's comparable to what Datum is doing, where you just download like one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But basically Bitcoin Core does not speak or does not understand any of that. All it does is just create new block templates for you. And the way the Stratum software talks to the node is using this thing called IPC, inter-process communication.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a more efficient way than RPC, what we had before.
Okay.
And that was all part of Bitcoin Core V30, so we might have even covered it 2 or 3 episodes ago. But
what's new? Because I imagine you could already solo mine, for example, with Bitcoin Core. You could already construct a block, right? You could already say, I want to mine or if yeah, I were
Stratum
to mine.
Yeah, Stratum V1 or just Stratum has been around forever. And that was using the RPC. And you would call a method called get block template. And it would create a very large JSON blob with all the transactions you need, etc.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that was that it was kind of poll-based. So you as the mining software or the miner, you need to constantly tell your node, like, hey, do you have can you make a new block for me? Can you make a new block for me?
Mm-hmm.
Etc. And there was a way to say, okay, make me a block and let me know when there's a better block available.
Mm-hmm.
But the only thing it did was check if anything changed in the mempool.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there's a long time ago that was actually interesting, but nowadays the mempool changes all the time. So you would just get a new block every fraction of a second, which is not useful.
That's not useful?
No, you don't want to have a new block if it's not any better. So if something sure. changed in the mempool, it could be like the bottom 1 gigabyte of your mempool changed and you get a new template. That's not
and
useful.
Better. So it sounds like this maybe ties into the first thing with the cluster
mempool. So what's the Stratum V2 stuff lets you do, the IPC interface lets you do is first, you ask for a block template. That's kind of similar to how it worked before.
Yeah, a little bit more what goes into a block.
Yeah, a little bit more efficient in terms of the encoding.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't, for this discussion, doesn't matter. And then you can subscribe to updates. And in particular, you can say, give me a new block if the fees have gone up by at least 1 sat per V-byte.
Right.
So not any change in the mempool, but like the actual block itself is better.
Yeah, okay.
And you can make it 1,000 or whatever number there is because you have some mining infrastructure, some ASICs that maybe you don't want to give them a new template like 100 times a second because it takes them time to update.
Right.
And updating is at that when it's updating is not mining, so you're losing some revenue. So maybe you only want a new template if it's 100 sats or whatever number makes sense.
Right. Okay. So if I understand correctly, this is not technically a Stratum V2 upgrade, but it is very compatible with Stratum V2. So Bitcoin
exactly.
Core 31 released something that's particularly compatible with Stratum V2 and specifically when it comes to creating your own blocks, as a miner deciding what transactions you want to include in a block.
Yeah, this
and
was
then,
in
and
in
then
in
you
V30.
Need some other you still need some other pieces of software that's the actual Stratum V2 software that takes that data and mines or connects to a pool and or whatever else is needed. We don't have to get into that.
So you still need to install some extra software, but Bitcoin Core has methods that are tailor made for that software, but could be used by some other mining protocol too.
Right.
Well, could even be used for Stratum V1 style mining, right? If you wanted to, if you run some pool software, it could use the IPC too.
Right, and you mentioned Datum, so is this also compatible with Datum?
If they want to. They're not currently using it, but they could. As far as I know, there's nothing magic that they're doing that doesn't work with this, and otherwise they should open a GitHub issue.
Do you know why they don't use it?
I think partly because they were building this before the IPC interface was even finished. So it's a matter of just sequencing.
Because Bitcoin Core is woke, source. That's what I heard.
That's possible. Maybe there's some evil feature in there. I remember making a GitHub issue on the Bitcoin.
We were just discussing ASMAP. That's at the very least a bit queer, don't you think?
So I was making a GitHub issue on the Bitcoin Core repo asking the Datum people, like, hey, is there something you need in the IPC interface? And I think Luke probably replied with something like, well, you guys are fascists or dictators or something like that. So, like, okay, I guess not. But they can still ask for things if they're missing something.
Right. Okay. In any case, this is very compatible with Stratum V2.
Mm-hmm. And so this was already in V30, but V31 just made it better. They fixed some bugs, added some whistles, some bells.
Right.
So it's great.
Okay.
I think that's all I've got. So anything else?
Yeah, I think so as well. I mean, no, I think this was our 100th episode then, Shores.
Excellent. Well, thank you again then for listening to Bitcoin
Explained.